We're glad to have with us during this session Dr. Howard Searle and Dr. Doug Alder. The paper that will be presented is Prolegomena, or Prolegomena, depending on your view, to a study of the role of God in LDS history. Dr. Howard Searle received his PhD in history from UCLA. He's currently employed by the church educational system and works currently at the LDS Institute here at the University of Utah. His paper will be responded to by Douglas Alder, in charge of the Honors Program at Utah State University. Doug is formerly president of the Mormon History Association. So we'll hear from the paper, then a response. Following the response, we'll open the floor to questions to either our speaker or the respondent.
Thank you, Alan. I'd like to, first of all, just to make a statement about Mormon history and faith. Although the authors and compilers of Mormon historical apologia have never developed a clear or coherent philosophy of history, we've been strongly influenced by the historical themes of the Bible and of the Book of Mormon. This historical perspective has been described by Richard Bushman aptly as follows. One pervasive theme is the tension between man and God. Class struggles, dynastic adventures, technological change, economic forces are all subordinated to this one overriding concern. Human obedience and divine intervention preoccupied the prophets who told the story. Where is God leading the Nephites? Will he help Nephi get the plates of Laban? Will Laman and Lemuel repent? Will God protect the Nephites on the voyage? Will they serve him in the new land? The prophets are most interested in what God does for man and their willingness in turn to serve him. All events take on meaning as they show God's power or as they depict people coming to him or falling away. The excitement of the story often lies in finding out what God will do or how the people will respond. As would be expected of prophet historians who had experienced God's glory, the fundamental axis of every story stretches between earth and heaven. Pro-Mormon history has attempted to portray this same scope and metaphysical perspective as the Book of Mormon, as it recounts the story of God's dealings with his saints of the latter days. The central narrative of the history deals with the story of God's revelations to Joseph Smith and to his successors, and the implementation of these divine communications in restoring and building up the kingdom of God on earth. Now, the following two corollaries of this main theme are also consistent threads running through the history. One, the tension and conflict which arises out of the saints' attempt to carry out the will of God against the opposition of wicked men. And two, the struggle of the saints to be worthy of the blessings and destiny which God has bestowed upon them. Although the enemies of God often thwart the work of the kingdom, and the saints are slow to reform their lives and obey the revealed laws of God, history still proceeds in a providential pattern of events that contributes to the purging and strengthening of Zion and brings the millennial reign of Jesus Christ ever closer. Pro-Mormon history, as you can see, clearly falls within the Judeo-Christian providential history writing tradition, in which religion and history are inseparably connected. It's been common since the development of the modern critical history to see a dichotomy between faith and history, a view which is exemplified in the following little anecdote. A theologian who had written an eloquent history of the Reformation is said to have met the historian Rank in Berlin and embraced him as he would a confrere. "Ah, please," said the father of scientific history, drawing himself away, "there is a great difference between us. You are first of all a Christian. I am first of all a historian. Well, historians of the Judeo-Christian tradition have tended to minimize this great difference and have produced what is sometimes called a history faith. Tryggvior Tholfsen has described this fusion of history and faith in ancient Israel in these words: Yahweh, the God of Israel, was preeminently a God of history, who made a covenant with his chosen people, delivered them from bondage, presided over their settlement in Canaan, and maintained a continuing interest in their affairs. At every point, their religion was historically oriented. They defined their relationship with Yahweh by recounting a sacred history. Their sacred literature took the form of historical narrative. From the very outset, their religion and their historical sense were indissolubly fused. Whether they considered the present or anticipated the future, the events that had unfolded under Yahweh's guidance remained a living reality in their consciousness. In Mormon theology, the unembodied Jehovah of the Old Testament is the incarnated Jesus Christ of the New. And so it is the same God who presides over his people in modern as well as ancient times. God's modus operandi, as portrayed in LDS history, often resembles that of the Old Testament as he speaks through his prophets, reestablishes his covenant among men, directs the Exodus to a promised land, protects his saints from their enemies, and blesses or punishes his chosen people according to their faithfulness. The Christian interpretation of history has its roots in the Jewish scriptures, both the Old and the New Testaments. And therefore, history has always been an integral part of the Christian faith. Now, if Christianity were merely a system of ethics, its history would not be of paramount importance. But Christianity is more than moral teachings. It includes a divine Redeemer who was born, crucified, and resurrected in history. Christian faith is founded in history, and the reliability of the sources which describe these historical events is a matter of the utmost importance to Christians. Frederick F. Bruce argues, "Does it matter whether the New Testament documents are reliable or not? Is it so very important that we should accept them as truly historical records?" Christianity as a way of life depends upon the acceptance of Christianity as good news. And this good news is intimately bound up within the historical order, for it tells how, for the world's redemption, God entered into history, the eternal came into time, the kingdom of heaven invaded the realm of earth, and the great events of the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. This historical once-for-allness of Christianity makes the reliability of the writings which purport to record this revelation a question of first-rate importance." End of quote. Christopher Dawson further explains, "For the Christian view of history is not merely in the direction of history, of the direction of history by divine providence. It is a belief in the intervention of God in the life of mankind by direct action at certain definite points in time and place. The doctrine of the incarnation, which is the central doctrine of the Christian faith, is also the center of history." He thought it was appropriate that the calendar should be dated from that event. Well, not all religions have this historical orientation. William F. Albright observed that most of the world's religions have, quote, "little or no historical consciousness," unquote. Their origins are often obscure or even lost in the unrecoverable past. Judeo-Christianity, by contrast, is the only world religion that has a completely historical orientation. Albright considers Mormonism an important offshoot of this Judeo-Christian heritage, which he says continues to exhibit marked historical tendencies. Well, Judeo-Christian history is a vision of history, sub specie, eternitatis, an interpretation of time in terms of eternity and of human events in the light of divine revelation. This view represents a reversal of contemporary historical values and judgments. For the real meaning of history transcends the mundane phenomena studied by man to discern the mystery of divine purpose. Such history concerns itself first with the story of God's dealings with his people, and second, with the interpretation of external history in the light of this central purpose. Traditional Mormon history, then, seems to be an expression of this school of Judeo-Christian history. Now, Mormon history, like Judeo-Christian history, concerns itself with the struggle of the saints of God against the wickedness of the world. This view of history found its classical expression in Augustine's City of God, which interprets the course of universal history as, quote, an unceasing conflict between two dynamic principles embodied in two societies and social orders, the city of man and the city of God, Babylon and Jerusalem, which run their course side by side. The Judeo-Christian view of history, of course, dominated Western civilization from the time of Augustine in the 5th century, and Christian historiography developed and evolved through Bede, Dante, Bowden, Bossuet, and Acton. During this period, the anecdote related above could have been reversed. Rank, in a previous incarnation, of course, enthusiastically embraces a great medieval saint, let us say Bernard, as a comrade. But the saint draws himself away, saying, "You are a chronicler of the city of man. I am a citizen of the city of God. Between us, there is a great gulf fixed." The Judeo-Christian philosophy of history was transplanted to America by the Puritans and other English nonconformists of the 17th and early 18th centuries. In many ways, Mormon history resembles 17th century Puritan history, which has been described by John Higham as follows. He says, "It is our great duty," enjoined a Massachusetts clergyman, "to be the Lord's remembrances or recorders. History told not merely the doings of men, it set forth the actions of God. His will directed every event," to these Puritans. The history recorded in Scripture and unfolded in subsequent happenings offered the principal clue to his otherwise inscrutable design. To ignore history was to remain in heathen darkness, and to distort or delimit its fullness was self-deceiving. In their passion to tell all, crops, crimes, fashions, and business transactions, as well as public events, were all enumerated. God had called them to this remote place to complete the Protestant Reformation and thus to lead the way for all mankind. In the grand strategy of history, they were enacting the crucial modern chapter. The outcome was uncertain and the record equivocal. They searched it proudly for evidence of their faithfulness and anxiously for signs of their failings. Well, the Puritans borrowed the chosen people concept from the Old Testament and viewed their colonization of America as part of a divine plan. Their history represented an unfolding of God's foreknowledge and designs and was written to justify and reinforce their deep-felt sense of mission. Now, just as Puritan history had to meet the prescription of Calvinist theology, so Mormon history was written to conform to the providential design and eschatological timetable as they were revealed in the Restoration. Now, in the process of secularization in the 19th century, Christian views of history began to lose their favored position. And by the early 20th century, the secular view of history prevailed. Since World War I and II and the many wars of more recent years and other crises of this secular age, there has been a renewal of interest in Judeo-Christian ideas of history. And early Mormon history, with its traditional views, has enjoyed greater toleration, I believe, because of this trend. Now, to the early Mormon historians, it was a sacred duty to record the intervention and influence of God in modern times. And so from the very beginning, their accounts were an affirmation of faith as well as an historical narrative. History and faith were so intertwined in early Mormonism that segments of the early history were canonized as part of the scriptural heritage which was to kindle and sustain the faith of future generations. The major events of Mormon history were endowed with the highest religious and ideological significance, and the result was a history in which faith was the dominant and pervasive element. Well, God's sovereignty over history. Although sometimes provincial in its scope, Mormon history has often portrayed God's sovereignty over the history and destiny of the whole earth. This broader view of history has usually been related to the dispensation cycle, which has been described as follows. The most common device among Mormons for comprehending the whole of world history within the scope of Revelation has been the concept of dispensation. The revelation of knowledge and the bestowal of priesthood power is seen as a pattern repeated through history to various people in many places. Usually an apostasy follows each dispensation of divine blessings, so that history follows the path of an undulating curve. Each dispensation raises men toward God, then they fall away only to be lifted by the succeeding dispensation. Now, the restoration through Joseph Smith was seen as the culmination of this sequence of dispensations, for his mission was to inaugurate the last dispensation in which the world would be warned and prepared for the rapidly approaching millennium. With implicit faith in these eschatological views, early Mormon historians saw the history of the church as well as that of all nations moving inevitably toward its predicted destiny. In his edited version of the Church Annals, B.H. Roberts further developed the concept of dispensations in his introductions and notes, as he tried to relate the events of Mormon history to what had happened in previous dispensations and to what was prophesied for the future. The role of God in LDS history. Pro-Mormon historians have never had an objective formula or clearly defined criteria for identifying the interventions or influence of God in the affairs of men. Many of the earlier writers had recently defected from Calvinism, where they had been indoctrinated in the ideas of predestination and divine retribution, and like other Christians of the period, were inclined toward the reverent view that, quote, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. Church scribes and historians were often slow to apply some of the principles and guidelines of the church's newly acquired scriptures and revelations to the interpretation of LDS history, and like other religious Americans of the time, had a tendency to see the will of God in almost everything that happened. However, credulity was not quite equated with faith by Mormon historians, and they often questioned or tested the reliability of many accounts of unusual or marvelous phenomena. In 1859, for example, George A. Smith, the church historian, was discussing with Brigham Young the miraculous story in Lucy Mack Smith's history of how David Whitmer had accomplished 2 days' work in less than a day and also had his fields spread with plaster by unknown helpers. President Young commented, "He was willing to believe a big story if it was true." B.H. Roberts later deleted from the church annals the account of the miraculous events which were supposed to have accompanied the martyrdom of Joseph Smith with this explanation: "It is wholly apocryphal, and the great determining facts of Mormonism rest on no such questionable witnesses as Daniels and Brackenbury to alleged miraculous displays of divine power connected with the prophet's death, nor upon any such documents as this." In most pro-Mormon history, the blessings and revelations have not been regarded as gratuitous, but have usually been seen as following such antecedents as a strongly felt problem or need, diligent seeking, faith, and worthiness. God's intervention in human affairs was generally made known through the declaration of the church's prophet or the personal testimony of some trusted elder or saint. These events, however, must correspond with reality as it was perceived and be consistent with other fundamental principles of Mormonism. Discerning the acts of God by a prophet, elder, or member was, of course, an intuitive process and was governed by such principles as personal righteousness, desire to know, faith in God, and conscientious seeking. Miraculous or providential phenomena, which were carefully described and documented by the church recorders, were often judged by the majority of the saints to have had a divine origin. Such accounts were sometimes canonized, and as matters of faith, incorporated into the conscious reality of the Latter-day Saints. God's intervention sometimes came by way of judgments upon the wicked. These incidents have much in common with the judgments of the Old Testament, the ancient Greek formula of nemesis, and the Calvinist doctrine of divine retribution. It is not only the saints' persecutors and enemies who are smitten, but often the rebellious and disobedient within the church. Now, in fitting events into this cause and effect pattern of divine retribution, Mormon historians have not always insisted, as did Gilbert and Sullivan, that the punishment fit the crime. As with the Greek doctrine of nemesis, great calamities were often attributed to rather trifling causes. Lucy Smith asserted that a tavern keeper and two members of his family had died of the smallpox because the man refused to buy a copy of the Book of Mormon from Samuel Smith. Although the tavern keeper was the fifth person to turn away Samuel that day, his family was apparently the only one which suffered this immediate punishment. The history of Joseph Smith, as published in the Millennial Star, contained an extract from a report by James Sloan, a missionary in the British Isles, which reported three incidents of divine retribution. The Marquis of Downshire, he reported, who oppressed the saints at Hillsborough in Ireland, has had the pleasure of his son, Lord William, being killed by his horse at a hunt in England a few weeks past, and Mr. Riley, his agent, who aided in their abuse, has received the third attack of some paralytic affliction and is obliged to resign his office. His son, again, who has headed the mob to annoy the saints and prevent their preaching, has gone to Cork in bad health and is not expected to recover. So much for them. The narrative of Zion's Camp suggests that a Mrs. Moss and three other members of her family had perished in Missouri because she was afraid of the cholera which had broken out in the Mormon camp, and she had refused the men's request for a drink of water. Well, there were other punishments recorded that seemed to be more justly matched to the offense. The Missourians who were poised to attack Zion's camp were obstructed by several providential squalls and a severe rain and hailstorm that resulted in the drowning of a boastful mob leader, the death of another Missourian who was struck by lightning, the soaking of the mob's gunpowder, and the complete isolation of the Mormons from their attackers. In the early Mormon formula of divine retribution, the Missourians who attacked and drove the Mormons out of the state, the Illinois mobbers who persecuted the saints and martyred the prophet and patriarch, the state officials who acquiesced or lent support to these depredations, and the President of the United States and other politicians who would not uphold the civil rights of the Mormons as guaranteed by the Constitution, were all to feel the weight of the hand of God upon them. Where the original compilers of Mormon history were not always able to witness and record the execution of these divine judgments, B.H. Roberts, with the advantage of time and hindsight, could sometimes provide confirmation of appropriate punishments in his footnotes. Well, interpretations of early Mormon history, which are based on the formula of swift divine retribution, are assertions that are rooted in faith and cannot be supported by any verifiable cause and effect relationship. In his later editing of the history, B.H. Roberts rejected several of these incidents as unreliable or superstitious. And some modern Mormon writers, such as Oaks and Hill and their Carthage conspiracy, have not always found confirmation of the doctrine in either the facts of history or the tenets of their faith. Although Mormonism espouses the principles of eventual justice and judgment based on personal choice and conduct, many of these incidents of rapid divine retribution in early Mormon history have appeared to many modern saints to be more of a reflection of the New England Calvinist heritage of some of the early saints and writers than a careful application of the principles of Mormonism to the interpretation of LDS history. That brings us to the idea of man and natural law in Mormon history. Although Mormon historians have acknowledged the sovereignty of God over history, they have not seen God as the only causal factor in human affairs. Man, who possesses an eternal free will and the laws of nature, are also free to operate. The relationship of these causal factors has been summarized by my friend George T. Boyd as follows. The Latter-day Saint view of history holds that the issues of this world are neither wholly under the influence of natural forces nor completely in the hands of men, but that in a real sense the issues of history are in the hands of God. But this does not mean the abrogation of freedom. Freedom and voluntarism combine in the agency of man to make possible both failure and success. In some matters, God is completely independent of man, such as in his sustaining of the natural order. But in other matters, God is quite obviously dependent on man's cooperation. In Mormon history, both predestination and determinism are rejected. Man is seen as a free agent who either succeeds or fails as he's willing to work in partnership with God to implement the revealed plan for human happiness and salvation. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints sees both God and man in a temporal, which means historical, context, explains Richard D. Pohl. But it has developed no authoritative system or systematic statement of the philosophical implications of these temporal relationships. Although God, man, and natural law all have their role in Mormon history, the sphere of each has never been clear, and there is a tendency to ascribe to the power of God many phenomena which are not understood or which may prove to be advantageous. Although man's role as an activator of history is often recognized, it's sometimes confused by what's been called the marionette bias. This built-in bias of Mormon history has been described by Leonard Arrington as follows. One gets the impression from some of our literature and sermons that the prophets and their associates in the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve were pious personages who responded somewhat mechanically, as if by conditioned reflex, to explicit instructions from on high, and that God manipulated the leaders much as a marionette in a puppet show. The church leaders themselves were not significant agents in history. Now, those familiar with Mormon history and theology recognize the marionette bias as a distortion of early church leaders' actual role in the history of the church. To study the mentality, personality, character, and deeds of these men is indeed to study the activators of Mormon history. In Mormon doctrine, there are many statements relating to God, man, intelligence, free will, freedom, time, space, and natural law, which are all relevant to the interpretation of the roles of God, man, and law in history. But these concepts have never been integrated into a clear, internally consistent philosophy of history by Mormon historians. Now, of course, the whole question of a philosophy of history is so intertwined with the faith of the Latter-day Saints that it has always been an extremely sensitive subject. and one that has usually been slighted or avoided. Although no official philosophy of church history has ever been promulgated, some leaders of the church have been reluctant to allow private interpretations of the Mormon past. On the other hand, individual Mormon historians have been reticent about their personal interpretations because of the fear that their faith, orthodoxy, or loyalty would be questioned. Until this situation is alleviated, there is a strong deterrent to any significant revisionist interpretations of early Mormon history from at least within the Mormon fold.